science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Well, welcome aboard. Another week has passed. Time for some more science, more entertainment, a little bit more fun. And the first thing I'd like to do today is actually invite you. On the 23rd of May, we're going to be celebrating a birthday. Not my personal birthday, but a birthday of sorts, because it will be 25 years since we opened the McGill Office for Science and Society. Of course, I've been at McGill much longer than that, but it was all formalized in terms of this outreach program 25 years ago. And we're going to have a little celebration, and here's the way it's going to work. Josh Fried is going to be the moderator, and I'll get into a discussion with him about what we have done in the last 25 years, about the science stories, about how we debunked some of the pseudoscience. And of course, I'll also do some little chemical demonstrations, a little magic to give everyone a flavor of what it is that we do. Now, in order to attend, the only thing that we ask you to do is to register so we have an idea of who's coming, because space is limited. So here's what you can do. You go to our website, which is mcgill.ca/OSS, so mcgill.ca/OSS, and you will immediately see in the invitation there, and you can just click saying that you do want to come. The only thing that we ask is that if we say that you do want to come, then do come. Because unfortunately, you know, we've had experience in the past where we get all kinds of people signing up. People, of course, will do that anyway because there's no cost involved. And then they don't come. And we have, in the meantime, had to say no to a lot of people who would have liked to come. So please, if you do register, make it a, you know, good chance that you're going to come. So it's at 7 o'clock on May 23rd in the Automaz building at McGill. And we're going to have a lot of fun with Josh Fried, who, of course, you know from the Gazette. He's a very humorous columnist. Okay, anyway, I'll be reminding you of this several times before May 23rd. Anyway, let's get going here. I want to tell you a story about the first neurotransmitter. Ask any student who has taken an introductory course in physiology how information is transmitted from one nerve cell to another, and they will immediately blurt out neurotransmitters. Indeed, the message is via a signaling molecule that, in response to an electrical stimulation that travels down a nerve, is released into the synapse, the tiny gap that separates nerve cells. This then fits into a receptor on an adjacent cell, much like a key fits into a lock. When the fit is just right, it triggers an electrical response that travels down the nerve cell and causes release of signaling molecules at the other end. These then migrate towards a receptor in another nerve or muscle cell, and the message gets transmitted along. Such signaling molecules are known as neurotransmitters, and dozens are known to function in the human body. Credit for the discovery of the first neurotransmitter goes to German-born physician Otto Loewi, who in 1921 removed the beating hearts from two frogs and immersed them in a saline solution that allowed them to keep beating. One of the hearts had the vagus nerve that controls the beating of the heart still attached, while the other did not. By electrically stimulating the vagus nerve, Loewi made the first heart beat slower. Then he took some of the liquid bathing the first heart and applied it to the second heart. Amazingly, the second heart then began to beat slower, proving that the vagus nerve released some soluble chemical that controls the heart rate. That soluble chemical turned out to be acetylcholine, the first neurotransmitter ever identified. Lowy, who was Jewish, received the 1936 Nobel Prize for Medicine, but just 2 years later was forced out of Austria, where he was professor at the University of Graz by the Nazis. He ended up continuing his career in the U.S. at New York University. There's a fascinating footnote to this story. The solution that was used to keep the frog hearts beating outside the body was the result of a lucky accident. In the late 1800s, there was great interest in exploring whether tissues could be kept functioning outside the body. An obvious idea was to immerse them in blood, which did keep tissues functioning but was difficult to work with. It was known that plasma, the liquid that remains where blood cells are removed, contains various salts that are critical for the proper functioning of cells. Dr. Sidney Ringer at University College London had his assistant make up a water solution containing salts such as sodium chloride, potassium chloride, to see if this could keep tissues alive. It did. But when Ringer tried to repeat the experiment, it failed. It turned out that the assistant was sloppy and had not followed Ringer's instructions to prepare the solution with distilled water. He didn't think it was important to go to the bother of distilling water, and he used water supply through London's pipes. This water contained calcium, which was critical to keep cells functioning. And today, Ringer's solution, which has been further modified, is widely used in hospitals to restore the correct concentration of salts in the body. As you can see, sometimes carelessness in the lab pays off. But usually it's not a good idea to be careless. Usually you want to follow procedures as closely as possible. Well, ever since Lowy's very clever imaginative experiment, many other neurotransmitters have been identified. I don't know what the last count is, but it is over 50. And these, of course, are all critical for the proper functioning of the human body. And excess of neurotransmitters, deficiency of neurotransmitters will cause problems. Now, perhaps the neurotransmitter that has been, I guess, in the news the most, at least in the lay press, is dopamine, because deficiency of it is linked to Parkinson's disease. And overabundance of dopamine is also linked to various kinds of mental problems, so that you want to have your dopamine be just the right concentration in the bloodstream. And as you probably know, because it has been determined that Parkinson's disease associated with a low level of dopamine, the medications that are used to treat Parkinson's disease are medications that will up the production of dopamine by the body. And these work very well. Levodopa is the classic medication that is used in the treatment of Parkinson's disease. So as you can see, these neurotransmitters are not just of theoretical interest. They have great practical utility. And all of this goes back to Otto Lowy, who dripped a solution over a beating heart, took a few drops of that solution, applied it to a second heart, unconnected to the animal, and amazingly, that heart began to beat. That showed that there was something in that solution that triggered physiological activity, and the idea of a neurotransmitter was born. We'll check traffic. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll be right back.
Life's everyday mysteries solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
Hey, my guest is a colleague, Dr. Josh Bloom. And we share a lot of interest, especially in making science come alive and debunking all the nonsense. And Josh does this at the American Council for Science and Health, where he is director of chemistry and pharmaceutical science. His background is in organic chemistry, synthetic organic chemistry. So he's just the right guy to chat with when we're talking about extracting caffeine from coffee beans using a solvent, methylene chloride. And the reason we are chatting about this is because there was a study that came out that implied that this was a horrific activity and that people should stay away from decaf coffee because it contains a carcinogenic solvent. So, Josh, you want to bring us up to date on just who did this study, what the claim is, and what the validity is?
Well, the Environmental Defense Fund, when you can substitute any of the environmental groups, so it doesn't really matter who did it, because they all use the same procedures for scaring you. But this one, they're all the same. It gets frustrating and boring. They take a chemical which has some harm, especially at a high dose, and then they ignore the dose and refer to all the animal tox and carcinogenicity studies and say, we got to ban it. So these guys go back to the 15th century or before, because the dose doesn't make the poison, according to these groups.
Now, what's the methylene chloride connection here?
Well, there are three or four ways to decaffeinate coffee. And there's a water method, a CO2 method, ethyl acetate, and methylene chloride. So I'm sure you spent enough time in the lab to know what the best solvent is of those four, and it's methylene chloride, hands down. Methylene chloride dissolves everything. It's just, it's fantastic for doing extractions. So it's called the European method, I believe, uses methylene chloride to pull the caffeine from the coffee beans after they've been pre-treated in a number of ways. And it works very effectively. Caffeine is extremely soluble in methylene chloride, and it's just like taking off nail polish with acetone and come right off.
Now, methylene chloride is volatile, right? So the fact is that during processing, any residue that is left will evaporate.
Well, I don't suggest anyone try this, but if you take a dropper and drop it on your skin, it's gone in 1 second. It boils at 103, your skin's 99 or whatever it is. It's gone instantly. Of course, it'll burn your skin pretty bad. Not physical burn, it just feels like a burn that lasts a few seconds. Given what the coffee has to go through during the decaffeination process, I find it impossible that there's any methylene chloride in there whatsoever, because it's heated at 400 or 500 degrees, and then the coffee's boiled itself. So the one would expect tiny amounts of methylene chloride, if any, to be in your little pot of decaf coffee. And in fact, the findings were true. The numbers are all over the place, but it was somewhere between a half a part ppm, part per million, and 10 part per million. So more likely to be closer to one or two than it is to be 10. But even at 10, if you do a little math, you'll see that it's harmless. But I chose two as kind of a happy medium. And I did a little math, which is always a dreadful mistake for me, because I've pretty much forgotten everything I ever learned about it. Fortunately, ChatGPT does math just fine. So I just ask it to do problems for it. And if it's wrong, I just blame them. But if you do the math and make certain assumptions about the amount of coffee you use to brew a cup, it's about 2 tablespoons, you come up with a number of about 0.04 milligrams per serving of methylene chloride.
Right. Just to put it into context for people, a milligram is 1/1000th of a gram, which is a very, very small amount. And we're talking about less than one milligram.
It's a 25 to 50 milligram, 25 to 50 milligram, it would have to be that 25 to 50 fold more toxic than either ricin or fentanyl to be of any kind of a danger. Just to put it all in perspective, the lethal dose of ricin is about 1 milligram, and fentanyl it's 1 to 2. So is methylene chloride 50 times more potent than as a toxin than ricin? I don't think so.
No, of course it isn't. But what do you
been
think?
Dead a long time ago.
What do you think is the motive for the Environmental Defense Fund to basically?
It's always the same motive. It's always
money?
The same motive. Yeah. I mean, you saw this with glyphosate, and you saw it with talc powder. You saw it with the opioids, and just. There's an enormous amount of money to be made by scaring the public and misinforming them. And the basic misinformation is that a little bit of methylene chloride, or in this case a minuscule amount, is as harmful as the huge amounts they use in rat carcinogenicity studies.
Yeah, right.
When, in fact, the rat is probably like swimming through beakers of methylene chloride and still didn't get cancer. And we're talking about millions and millions of times less. So
right.
The American
but,
public
all
does
the
not
news
understand
services,
this.
All the news services pick up these press reports and make hay with them, and the scare just continues. So,
well,
you know, we see this, as you said,
model.
We see this with all kinds of stuff.
Right. Well, the press gets its headlines, and the scarier the better. The word gets out on a dangerous new chemical, and all of a sudden, I'd bet my life that there's a class action lawsuit against coffee companies that is in waiting somewhere, because they will find people that drank decaf coffee and got cancer. And then that
I think we can certainly say that the likelihood of methylene chloride causing cancer from drinking decaf coffee is essentially zero when you take into the number.
Zero.
So I think we can let people know that it's okay to drink decaf coffee. And the biggest risk probably is from dropping a cup and cutting themselves. Anyway, thanks, Josh, for putting that into perspective. And you can go back to drinking your decaf coffee or whatever else coffee you're drinking.
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks very much. Okay. That was Dr. Josh Bloom from the American Council for Science and Health, who really does a great job in debunking some of these scares. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll check news and be right back.
It's all about chemistry. Science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
It's all about chemistry.
Passover is coming up. And at this time of the year, I like to give a little background to that story, although most people are familiar with it by and large, but it never hurts to go over some of these old tales. And faith and science generally walk along different paths, although sometimes intersect as when scientists muse about finding natural explanations for biblical events that appear to be supernatural. The 10 plagues of Egypt which led to Moses leading the Israelites out of slavery, are intimately connected to the Passover story. The final plague was the slaying of the firstborn of Egypt by the angel of death, while the firstborn of the Israelites were passed over. Is it possible that the plagues can actually be explained by a chain of natural phenomena triggered by changes in the climate and environmental disasters? Climatologists studying the ancient climate at the time have discovered a dramatic shift in the climate in the area some 3,000 years ago to suggest a time for the Exodus. By studying stalagmites in Egyptian caves, they have been able to rebuild a record of the weather patterns. Rising temperatures could have caused the River Nile to dry up, turning the fast-flowing river that was Egypt's lifeline into a slow-moving and muddy watercourse, perfect for the first plague, the Nile turning to blood. The hypothesis is that the color change could have been the result of a bloom of toxic freshwater algae known as Oscillatoria rubescens that is known to have existed 3,000 years ago and still causes similar effects today. The algae multiply in slow-moving warm waters with high levels of nutrition, and when they die, they stain the water red. The multiplication of the algae could also have set in motion the events that led to the second, third, and fourth plagues, the frogs, the lice, and the flies. The toxic algae could have forced the frogs to leave the water, causing them to perish on the dry land. Without predators to check their growth, flies and insects would have flourished. Since insects carry disease, livestock and people could have been affected, explaining the plagues of animals dying and humans contracting boils, possibly through the spread of anthrax bacteria. Another major natural disaster is thought to be responsible for triggering the 7th, 8th, and 9th plagues that bring hail, locusts, and darkness to Egypt. One of the biggest volcanic eruptions in human history occurred when Thera, a volcano that was part of the Mediterranean islands of Santorini, exploded around 3,500 years ago, spewing billions of tons of volcanic ash into the atmosphere. Volcanic ash can trigger hailstorms, and ash can also cause clouds to release their water content, and wet weather fosters the growth of locusts. Volcanic ash could also have blocked out the sunlight, causing the plague of darkness. What evidence is there for this? Pumice, which is stone made from cooled volcanic lava, has been found during excavations of Egyptian ruins, despite there not being any volcanoes in Egypt. Analysis of the rock shows that it came from Santorini volcano, providing physical evidence that the ash fallout from the eruption of Santorini did reach Egyptian shores. The cause of the final plague, the death of the firstborns of Egypt, has been suggested as being caused by a fungus that may have poisoned the grain supplies, of which male firstborn, who had had first pickings, and so would have been first to fall victim. Well, or could it all have been due to some divine intervention? Who knows? It is an interesting story, and it is, you know, the story that is often celebrated that is the essence of Passover, the fleeing of Jews from slavery in Egypt. And it's a great story in the sense that it has been celebrated for over 3,000 years, and it is something that has kept the people together. But the fact is that there really is no physical evidence for the Exodus to have occurred. There's no remnants of pottery or anything like that that one would have expected from wandering in the desert for 40 years, as the biblical story tells us. And there are no Egyptian records, no hieroglyphics that talk about, you know, Israelite slaves in Egypt. So most of this, of course, is just oral history, sort of, you know, handed down generation to generation with additions, subtractions, etc. But really, whether the story is factually correct or not doesn't really matter, because it serves its purpose, which is to keep people together. And this is something, you know, that Jews around the world know, that when they sit down to that Passover dinner, that's what others are doing at the same time, you know, all around the world. So I don't think it's so important to delve into, you know, whether or not this really happened the way we see it in the Ten Commandments, which is really one of the great movies of all time. I must say, it is the first movie that I ever saw in Canada, and I remember that very well. It was in the Rialto Theater, which is on Park Avenue near Bernard. And at that time, this goes back to I guess that would have been around 1960. That I saw it. And the movie was made, I guess, a few years before that. And the Rialto Theater at that time was a majestic theater, you know, with plush seats and a screen that at that time was very large. And it was the first movie that I ever saw in Canada, because until you know, virtually up to that time, children were not allowed into the theaters here in Montreal, because of a large fire that had killed something like 70 children in a movie theater in the 1940s. So anyway, I remember watching the Ten Commandments and the Rialto Theater on this, you know, giant screen. It was just amazing. The movie was very long. It even had an intermission. And you know that the special effects still stand up today. The Pillar of Fire was very well done. Now, obviously, with modern CGI, it would be better, but it was very, very well done. And the opening of the Red Sea also looked very, very good. You know, there are some movies that stand the passage of time well and some that do not. But I think the Ten Commandments has some really great scenes, majestic scenes. When you see them exit from Egypt and you see all the huge Egyptian monuments and you see the hundreds of people, and those really were hundreds of people because this was well before CGI. So there were numerous extras in those scenes. And Charlton Heston, of course, was excellent as Moses. And Yul Brynner was great as the Pharaoh Ramses. It's still a movie that I enjoy watching. And I'm sure it will be available on one of the channels this coming week because of Passover. But, you know, I watch the movie, I enjoy it, and I don't delve too much on whether or not it is historically accurate. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll check traffic and be right back.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
Let's address a topic that doesn't get much attention, but it does get a lot of use. That's toilet paper. Oh, you know, in ancient times, the handiest solution was, well, the hand, usually the left. That's why in some cultures, eating or even just touching someone with the left hand is still regarded as a sinister practice. Sinister, of course, comes from the Latin for left. The ancient Greeks used stones, while the Romans favored a xylus fungium, a natural sponge on a stick inserted through a vertical opening on the front of a stone toilet seat. There was no need to stand up to finish the job. Interestingly, modern incarnation of this device is available for overweight people, but instead of a sponge, the gadget holds a piece of toilet paper. In Africa, the large feathery leaves of the Peltophorum africanum tree, also known as the toilet tree, have a long history of use. Medieval monks used cut-up pieces of habits that had become too threadbare to wear. They refer to these as anatergium, from the Latin ani for anus and tergeo to scrape. In the 16th century, there were apparently enough rumblings about various wiping options for the Renaissance writer Rabelais to satirize them in his classic Gargantua and Pantagruel, a work that has a whole chapter devoted to different methodologies. His conclusion was that the best results were achieved with the head of a well-downed goose held between the legs. Rabelais claimed a further benefit in that, quote, you will feel in your rear a most wonderful pleasure. As far as I know, no corroborating evidence is available to demonstrate the benefits of such goosing. Henry VIII wasn't keen on taking matter into his own hands, so he appointed a groom of the king's close stool, whose job was to unsoil the royal rear. The close stool was a throne with a hole and a chamber pot. It was equipped with a lid that could be locked to ensure that only the king's bottom would enjoy the upholstered seat. Henry's daughter, Queen Elizabeth I, followed her father's practice, but changed the name of the attendant to the more delicate First Lady of the Bedchamber. Over in France, Louis XV's mistress, Madame de Pompadour, used only the finest French lace, while Madame de Maintenon, Louis XVI's second wife, favored the ultra-soft wool of merino sheep. In America, the large velvety leaves of the mullein plant were popular, but the most significant American contribution was, believe it or not, the corn cob. With the kernels removed, this proved to be so effective that even up to the 1940s, it was common to find corn cobs in outhouses along with catalogs from which pages could be torn. Farmlands in Middle America were sometimes referred to as the cob and catalog belt. There are Chinese references to wiping with paper as early as the 6th century, and evidence that special tissues were produced on a large scale for the imperial court by the 14th century. In North America, though, toilet paper did not appear until 1857, pretty late, when Joseph Gaietti introduced what was then called paper for the water closet. Given that pages from free catalogs were readily available, he needed a marketing gimmick. The health gambit fit the bill. Gaietti claimed that Americans were ruining their physical and mental health by wiping with printed paper that had death-dealing chemicals, such as lampblack, oxalic acid, oil of vitriol, and chloride of lime. His so-called medicated paper was pure as snow. Unlike the catalog paper, it wouldn't cause hemorrhoids and would, as he said, cheat physicians out of their fees. When flush toilets became more common, he cleverly changed the pitch to, this paper will dissolve so that it will not, like ordinary paper, choke the water pipes. The next breakthrough came with engineer Seth Wheeler, patenting the perforated toilet paper roll in 1877. And then Clarence and Irvin Scott took sales to new heights with an emphasis on softness. An ad featured a lady's complaint to a doctor that her husband was becoming abusive. Perhaps, the doctor suggested, he may be irritated by bad bathroom tissue. The paper was too rough, which he demonstrated by showing it was opaque to light while the light passed right through Scott Waldorf paper. Switching to this, he said, made this couple the happiest in town. Well, happiness also came to some consumers in the 1950s when colored toilet paper was introduced. They enjoyed making their bowel movements a more colorful affair. The air was mostly let out of that balloon As the environmental movement picked up steam in the 1980s and colored toilet paper vanished from the shelves. Today, there are a few companies that cater to nostalgia and produce dyed toilet paper. There are even novelty rolls that have pictures of politicians offering one a choice of yet another way to express disdain. And then there's the question of whether or not, you know, there's any risk involved with the dyes that are used in this colored toilet paper. Well, what do? We take a look at just what the chemistry of these dyes are, how easy it is to leach out of the paper. Do they get absorbed through the skin? And what actually are the medical consequences of those dyes getting into the body? Well, all you can do is make an educated guess because, of course, you can't monitor people for decades and have one group use colored toilet paper and the other not and see what happens. So we make educated guesses. And I think my educated guess is that there are a lot of things in life that are worrying about, but the color of toilet paper in terms of toxicity is not one of them. On the other hand, I'm not in favor of colored toilet paper because, of course, when it is produced, the industry does undoubtedly let some of these dyes into the environment, which we really don't need. So I'm quite happy with my white toilet paper. All right. Well, hopefully we've entertained you here today with all kinds of fascinating stories from decaf coffee to toilet paper. And we've run out of time. And I just want to wish all our Jewish listeners a very happy Passover. And we will see you same time, same station next week. Until then, I'm George Schwartz, hoping all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.